From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Dr. Casey Luskin, Associate Director of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture and author of Lessons Learned and Not Learned from the Evangelical Debate Over Adam and Eve in the upcoming issue of the Christian Research Journal. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Casey Luskin in their conversation.
The reason we find in our genome so many protein-coding-like sequences that don't actually produce proteins is not because they are discarded evolutionary junk DNA, but it's rather because they are designed to look and act exactly as they do, as important regulatory and control elements of gene expression. And again, we could just go through papers and top journals that have found evidence that pseudogenes perform these kinds of functions. A paper in the journal Cell stated that sequencing efforts have revealed 19,000 pseudogenes in humans, many of which are transcribed and often are well conserved, suggesting that selective pressure to maintain the pseudogenes exists. Selective pressure means it has a function that's being selected. A paper in the journal Bioessays from just last year said that we are finding function for pseudogenes in neurogenesis and inflammatory immune responses, and also they can be involved in cancer. And they said that necessitates revisitation of the notion that pseudogenes are quote-unquote evolutionary junk. I mean, it's directly challenging the claim that pseudogenes are evolutionary junk. A paper in the journal RNA said pseudogenes have long been labeled as junk DNA, failed copies of genes that arise during the evolution of genomes. However, recent results are challenging this moniker. Indeed, some pseudogenes appear to harbor the potential to regulate their protein-coding cousins. I mean, I could just keep going. But the bottom line is that there are many papers in the mainstream scientific literature from top journals. Another paper from Nature Reviews Genetics warns that pseudogene function is being prematurely dismissed due to dogma. And they're literally citing the dogma in biological evolutionary thinking today, where they said that, quote, the dominant limitation in advancing the investigation of pseudogenes now lies in the trappings of the prevailing mindset that pseudogenic regions are intrinsically non-functional. That's a fancy way of saying that it's because biologists are assuming that pseudogenes are non-functional that we're not discovering what they actually do. So if we can get rid of this junk DNA evolutionary mindset, we will be able to discover what pseudogenes are actually doing. And again, so this is all coming from top scientific journals. So I think that if we're willing to look at where the field of pseudogene research is going today, we can find that this assumption that they are sort of junk DNA that is shared by humans and apes that doesn't do anything, that shows our common ancestry, that paradigm is actually false.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because what you've essentially done is demonstrated that this is not consensus science, the notion that broken pseudogenes indicate that we share common ancestry with apes. This isn't really consensus science, but oftentimes we are told that it is consensus science and that if we challenge it, that will hinder the evangelism efforts of the church.
That's exactly right, Hank. We are told that if we challenge evolutionary science, we're bringing shame upon the Christian faith, and this hinders evangelism. I think the best way to reach people is to do good science, not to just uncritically accept whatever mainstream science is saying. If mainstream science is right, then absolutely, let's accept it. But if there are questions about the consensus, if we're claiming there's a consensus when there really is not a consensus on these questions, I don't see how that's a good way to make Christianity to look good. But unfortunately, as you've said, many theistic evolutionists would say that Christians, if they don't simply capitulate and fully accept evolutionary science, then they're making Christianity look bad. They're an embarrassment to the Christian church. And I think what this episode over Adam and Eve is showing is that those assumptions and those paradigms for Christianity to just bow before evolution, those paradigms are wrong. Because when we did that with Adam and Eve, Christians who said that evolutionary science had refuted Adam and Eve, that science turned out to be wrong. Even the Christians who were making those claims admitted that they were wrong. So I don't think that latching on to junk science, essentially, is a good way to be a witness for Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I want you to expand on scientific consensus. I mean, we heard so much about scientific consensus as we're going through the COVID-19 pandemic, now an endemic, I suppose, because I watched the State of the Union and no one was wearing a mask. But we heard so much about consensus science. And this is no small matter, particularly today. We have become, for example, energy dependent, because the alleged scientific consensus that unless we limit our dependence on fossil fuels, our planet is going to cease to be habitable, some say in less than a decade. And thus we're no longer a net energy exporter, but we have become energy dependent. But is this consensus a reality? Or is it a function sometimes of manipulating data in order to exaggerate the premise? Is it solid evidence, or could this be what I would think is sinister, what economics professors call stakeholder interests and incentives that not only affect the research of academics in the humanities, but in the sciences? Perhaps it has to do with motivated blindness. Perhaps it is shoddy research that is conducted by university professors and then repeated ad nauseum, ad infinitum by journalists. Talk about consensus science and how we often buy into paradigms without critically evaluating them.
Yeah, some great points there. Michael Crichton, the famous science writer who wrote the book that became the movie Jurassic Park, he passed away a number of years ago, but he wrote in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a great point about consensus science, Hank. He said, there is no such thing as consensus science. If it's consensus, it isn't science. If it's science, it isn't consensus, period. Okay, so I just think that that says everything you need to know about when people invoke the notion of consensus. When people invoke the consensus, it's typically because the science is not solid enough. That's actually what Michael Crichton went on to say. You try to invoke the consensus to shut down conversation about what the science really says. Science is not settled by vote counts. Science is settled by the evidence. And sometimes the majority view in science is absolutely right. And I don't have a problem with acknowledging that there can be a consensus, quote unquote, in science that is correct, that we should listen to. But sometimes the consensus can get things wrong. In fact, every single time that there has been a revolution in scientific thinking, that happened because the scientific consensus turned out to be wrong. I mean, you want to talk about plate tectonics, which was my field of study in my geology PhD, looking at how plates have moved over the Earth. Well, there was a time not that long ago. I mean, it was as recent as the 1970s or 1960s that most geologists, the consensus was that the plates of the Earth did not move, that there were not even plates of the Earth. And there was a revolution in geology because the consensus turned out to be wrong. So if geologists back then had said, well, you're not allowed to say this dissenting minority scientific view because it's not the consensus, we would have never had progress to discover in geology that plate tectonics is correct and that the plates actually do move. And now I'm a huge believer in plate tectonics. I think it's very well supported by the evidence. The good thing about science in that case was that it was the evidence that was able to decide what the right answer was, not this sort of politically charged invoking of the consensus in order to shut down minority scientific views. So I think we should become suspicious when we hear people invoking the consensus to try to shut down dissent or say that you have to capitulate or agree with this. You don't have the right to disagree with the consensus. We hear that all the time right now. And I'm telling you that the history of science shows that that view is not only completely false, it's actually very dangerous. And it prevents science from being able to progress when the consensus, quote unquote, turns out to be wrong.
Yeah, you know, one of the questions that we have, if you're not a scientist, how can you then have the temerity, the reckless boldness to doubt a scientific consensus? And so how would you advise someone who doesn't have the acumen that you do in the fields of science that you are conversant with to deal with this phrase that's sort of pressed upon us over and over again, scientific consensus?
Yeah, look, I appreciate the fact that sometimes scientific debates can be very technical and can be hard to understand. I think that there are a lot of efforts these days from folks on all sides of hot scientific topics and scientific debates to try to explain the evidence in popular terms, because people in the scientific community recognize that a lot of lay people want to understand these things, and that's difficult to understand the technical details. So what you can do is you can read books from multiple sides on a viewpoint. Get a book, a popular book that's pro-human caused global warming, and get a book that maybe is a skeptic of that view, and compare and contrast the two positions. Let's talk about evolution. Read a book by Richard Dawkins, and then read a book by Stephen Meyer. And they're both very good science writers, good at writing at a popular level. What does the evidence say about Darwinian evolution, the origin of life, these sort of basic evolutionary questions? And I would encourage people to look at the rhetoric that is used by different quote-unquote sides of these scientific debates.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Casey Luskin. Science and Christianity are often presented as contradictory opposites, when in fact, the fine-tuning and order of the universe and the specified complexity of life powerfully testify to intelligent design. With the Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith, you'll witness how the latest findings of scientists provide compelling reasons to acknowledge the mind and presence of a creator. To receive your copy of The Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. When you need answers about the Bible and the intersection of our faith and culture, you turn to the Bible Answer Man broadcast and the Christian Research Institute. But did you know we're entirely supported by God's provision through friends like you? In appreciation for your gift of ministry support today, we'll send you Hank's book, The Third Day, a convincing case study on the most important truth of Christianity, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Johnny Erickson Tada has said, Hank leaves no stone unturned, thoroughly portraying the resurrection as our grand hope, the glorious springboard from which we all dive into eternity. Strengthen your defense of the resurrection and increase your confidence in your own eternal future. Call 888-7000-CRI. or visit equip.org now. The evolutionary naturalist Richard Dawkins famously wrote that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Dawkins has spent a career trying to show that purposeful design in living things is really just an illusion. But is it? Could it be that our intuition of design in nature is correct after all, and we can know that it is? Yes, and you'll see why in the Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith. To receive your copy of the Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith, a rigorous and thorough defense of intelligent design, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Well, here once again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. Casey Luskin, as they continue their conversation.
And I would encourage people to look at the rhetoric of these scientific debates. If you see one side that is constantly trying to invoke the consensus to shut down the other, but then you see that the other side of the debate is citing evidence and citing scientific papers and explaining how the data backs up their positions, well, I think that can be a good indicator to you about which side is trying to use rhetoric to win the debate and which side is confident that they can rely on the evidence. I see this all the time in the ID evolution debate. When we go out, we constantly are opposed through name calling and ridicule and people who will frankly refuse to even dialogue with us. I won't go into the details on this, but I'm trying to organize a debate right now with a prominent YouTube channel that deals with controversial scientific topics. It's very well respected. And we have had complete inability to find a scientist who is willing to debate against me on the question of whether there is scientific evidence for intelligent design from the information in DNA. And we asked some leading evolutionary scientists who go out there and criticize intelligent design all the time, and none of them are willing to debate me on that topic. Now, why is that? If the evidence is on their side, they should have no qualms about being willing to debate an ID scientist. If I'm so wrong and the evidence is so clear, then go ahead and debate me. They'll be doing a service for their evolutionary camp by showing that critics of their view are wrong. But yet they're not willing to debate. Instead, we get name-calling and ridicule and all kinds of personal attacks and attempts to prevent us from being able to publish our papers in mainstream journals, denying, you know, if I'm sure that your listeners are aware of many of the pitfalls that pro-ID scientists have faced over the years. They've been denied tenure. They've been denied degrees. They've been fired from jobs. They've been refused to be hired because of their skepticism of Darwinian evolution. And meanwhile, the other side refuses to debate, all in the name of the consensus. This is not the way that people behave when they are confident that the evidence is on their side. So I would encourage people to both look at the evidence. I mean, I've cited evidence. I've quoted multiple papers from the peer-reviewed scientific literature showing that pseudogenes are now thought to have widespread function. Okay, so I'm giving you the evidence. You can look at my article that will be published in Christian Research Journal and get all the citations and check them out for yourself and see if you think I'm right. I have no problem with that. But I'm relying on evidence. I'm not trying to call my opponents names. I respect that they believe what they believe, but I just think that the evidence doesn't support their view. But when somebody doesn't behave like that and they're just citing the consensus to shut down discussion, that's when it's time to get suspicious.
Talk about the sociology of this, because there's tenure involved, there's job promotions involved, government grants, the media accolades, the social respectability, even Wikipedia entries. They collectively can do what the gulags did, but more subtly. Scientists, from a sociological perspective, I think, are under extreme pressure to toe the party line. And when they do, they receive enormous benefits. When they don't, they pay a very dear price.
No, that's certainly true. And this is well recognized in the sociology of science, Hank. If you read the book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, published by University of Chicago Press, very, very well-respected book about how scientific revolutions take place. What he says in that book, I mean, he's got no ideological axe to grind. He's just a historian of science. But he documents and recognizes in that book that people who are sort of from the old guard, that are established in their careers and are sort of, you know, very heavily invested in the sort of, you know, quote-unquote consensus view or whatever the sort of paradigm is, he calls them the reigning paradigms of the field. But those who are invested in those paradigms, he says, are infrequently, quote-unquote, intolerant, unquote, of new up-and-coming scientists who are challenging that reigning paradigm. And the way that he says scientific revolutions progress is that over time, the evidence begins to amass more and more, and you begin to see that there's a lot of data that the reigning paradigm cannot explain until eventually that paradigm goes into what he calls a crisis stage, where you have a paradigm in crisis, and then you'll have, hopefully, if there's a political ability to actually express dissenting views, then you can have a revolution in scientific thought. Now, Thomas Kuhn published his book in the 1970s. The plate tectonics revolution had just taken place in the scientific community in geology. I think that science was in a relatively healthy place at that time. Today, you know, what we could say 40 to 50 years later, science has changed a lot. Things are far more politicized. And people all over the ideological spectrum are complaining about this these days, that science has become heavily politicized now, where it is a lot harder to express dissenting scientific views. And all the sociological factors that Thomas Kuhn recognized are still in play, that people will invest a lot of their career and their publication record and their reputation on a particular paradigm or a particular viewpoint or quote-unquote consensus view. They will invest a lot into that, and it's hard for people to admit they're wrong and admit that what they've done over the course of their lifetime or their career might not have been correct. And so today, all those sociological factors that Kuhn recognized are still in play. The problem, I think, is that today, if you are an up-and-coming scientist, it is a lot harder for you to get a dissenting view out. Max Planck, the famous physicist, once said that scientific revolutions happen one funeral at a time. He was not suggesting that anybody should go out and obviously kill scientists. That's not the idea. That's what he's saying is that the way that scientific revolutions progress is that eventually the old guard of the reigning paradigm, they just naturally retire and die off and, you know, go away the way of the dodo through old age. And eventually new scientists who have open minds, younger generation scientists are able to come up, fill in the ranks, and their new ideas will take the place. Well, I'd like to think that that still has a chance to happen in the scientific community, especially when it comes to topics like evolution and intelligent design. I can tell you, Hank, one of the encouraging points for us at Discovery Institute is that over the last 10 or 15 years, we have had a small army of up-and-coming graduate students go through our summer seminar on intelligent design. And we have now seen a number of those scientists go on, and they're now taking their place as science faculty. They're doing intelligent design research. They're becoming that next generation of scientists who can fill in the ranks as these old evolutionary ideas are shown, you know, like junk DNA, for example, are shown to be wrong. They're coming in with new, fresh ideas. Hey, let's consider the possibility that junk DNA has function. Let's try these new ideas. And it may take a long time for these ideas to catch on because of the politicization of science, but I am hopeful that in the end, you know, the evidence still has a chance because there are a lot of up-and-coming scientists that support intelligent design and challenge evolution. But there is a problem today that there's a huge politicization in science that is making it harder for these minority dissenting scientific views to get out there.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about the intelligent design movement, and I'm really glad to get sort of an update on the progress that intelligent design has made. But so often, when I hear the moniker intelligent design, it is conflated with the notion that this is simply another way of appealing to the God of the gaps. So whenever you can't explain something, just say God did it.
Yeah, we hear that criticism a lot. In fact, I would say we hear that a lot from our theistic evolutionist friends who disagree with intelligent design. They will say that you're never allowed to bring God in as an explanation. You can only invoke natural explanations and natural mechanisms. It's what is called methodological naturalism, the idea that we can only use naturalistic and mechanistic explanations in science, and we can never use any other kind of explanations. Well, I would say that what they're engaging in is materialism of the gaps, where all explanations have to be materialistic and naturalistic, no matter whether we know that there are material explanations or not. You know, obviously there's no naturalistic explanation for the origin of life and many other things in evolutionary thinking today, but yet many theistic evolutionists will say you're not allowed to invoke intelligent design. We have to essentially, in my view, I would say that they're using a materialism of the gaps kind of approach. Now, why is intelligent design not a God of the gaps argument? Well, a God of the gaps argument says that basically, whenever you cannot explain something, then you invoke God, or in the case of intelligent design, you know, you're invoking an intelligent cause. And it's always based upon our supposed inability to explain something.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Casey Luskin. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of the Comprehensive Guide to Science and Faith, co-edited by Casey Luskin. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal, just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org.